Senate Judiciary Committee, Thursday, March 1st, 2001, at 12:30 p.m., room 343.
To order, and this is a time set for public hearing on Senate Bill 199. Senator Peter Courtney, you want to begin opening remarks, and the mics are not on?
Mic's not on, John.
Are the microphones on? They are on.
They are on?
Yes, sir, they are.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Peter Courtney, State Senator, District 17, as the committee knows, because I'm a member of this august committee, and I'm Salem-Keizer is my Senate district, and I'm here today to testify in support of SB 199, often referred to as Abandoned Baby Bill or Safe Recovery. And I'm joined by Debbie Ferris, who has come up from California at my request to discuss this issue with you, because there is no one in the country who has dealt more extensively with this issue, both in terms of developing legislation in the state of California, but also actually dealing with children who have died, the coroner's office, as well as individuals who have been sentenced to prison as a result of abandoning a baby and the baby dying. She's probably the leader in the country on this issue, and she has some interesting and riveting testimony to deliver. And what I'm going to do is, and I have to be the bad guy here to many of the witnesses. We've got a remarkable array of witnesses who have agreed to come down and to talk about this issue. I also want to thank you, Mr. Chair. We had a real glitch on this hearing today, as you know, and I went to the chair of Information and Management, Senator Vern Duncan, which his committee is going to start at 1, and the chair of Judiciary, and asked him to put a meeting on today, and they agreed to do so. So I know, Senator Duncan, you're going to have to leave at 1. I'm on your committee. I can't join you. I think you understand that. Senator Metzger's on that committee. I don't know whether he's going to stay here or go there. So we do have that situation in front of us, and it's regrettable, but we had already scheduled the witnesses coming in, and the thing had been scheduled today for 2 weeks before there was we discovered it didn't work. I'm going to quickly tell you why I got involved in this, but then I want to stop and turn it over to allow Debbie Ferris to speak. I would ask all those in the back, and I hate to say this, but I have to. We've got a large number of witnesses, and I would hope that if individuals can limit their testimony, even though a lot of their testimony is extremely emotional and riveting and the kind of thing you really need to hear to understand the magnitude of the public policy we're talking about here. And this will be one of my more dramatic public hearings, I think, in my 9 sessions. And I'm just grateful to you, Mr. Chair, and to members of this committee, because this is a great judiciary committee, that you'd allow me this opportunity. All I can tell you is there was a recent situation in Salem that this bill would not cover, where a baby was abandoned in a dumpster in West Salem. And without going into the particulars, while this bill wouldn't cover it, I got thinking, that's a pretty cruel situation. And I was aware that other babies have been abandoned, particularly in dumpsters, or left out in the cold. They've been left in situations, let's be very frank about it, they could not survive. I mean, the babies just couldn't survive. But somewhere I heard about a situation where there was a program or an idea that maybe an individual in this incredibly desperate situation, if we could just get them in that critical time in their life, and as you're going to hear from Debbie Ferris, it only involves a few number of hours in a person's life, where they're in this crisis situation so bad that they just go and do this. If we could only get them maybe just to leave it someplace, just someplace where the baby would have a chance to survive, that would be good public policy. And sure enough, I now go to the Debbie Ferris's of this world. There was a state in California, and even Texas, and a community in Alabama, where they were saying, hospital, just take it to a hospital. Now, I'm generalizing here. Our bill says more than that. Just leave it and go. Just leave it and go. No questions asked. Now, I am generalizing, and I'm being oversimplified. Well, it's a difficult emotional concept when you first hear it, because you want to say, anybody who does that ought to be prosecuted to the fullest of the law. I mean, that's the first instinct I think you have. But the problem is, the baby's dying. The baby's dead. And sure, you put him in jail, but the baby's dead. And couldn't it be, if we could get him as upset they could, to just to leave the child in a situation where he could get the help, wouldn't that be a better way to go? The numbers are not great, but there is at least, the numbers are great when you hear like California, and I don't mean to knock Debbie State, but they're into the 40s and 50s there, but that's a huge state. We are less dramatic here. We're averaging, I think, one every 2 years or something to that effect. There's been a number that are being one or two every 2 years, something like that in Oregon. Texas has dramatic figures, as to some counties. Texas is a bigger state. And so I put together a small work group, District Attorneys Association, the great Josh Marquis, who's here today, the hospital people. I asked them to come. I asked the health division people to come, Virginia Vanderbilt and some others, a small group. It wasn't a big work group, as I was found out. We started to work on this in the interim. Put together a bill. Continually, we introduced a bill. I think they're in front of you, Mr. Chair, as many as four amendments, because we continue to work this bill, trying to come up with something that people can accept, but will accomplish what we want. The bottom line, and after I say this, I will turn it over to Debbie Ferris, if you'll allow me to do so, Mr. Chair. The bottom line is to give that newborn, it's a newborn baby we're talking about, an opportunity to live. With that, Mr. Chair, if you'll allow me to do so, could I allow Debbie Ferris now to testify about her experiences and knowledge in this?
Just one brief admonition of the committee. We have a hand-engrossed version of the bill, which includes the four amendments that Senator Courtney spoke of. So as you're looking at the bill and reading it, read that dash one hand-engrossed bill as opposed to the other one. And Senator Courtney, I want to thank you for bringing the bill to us. And if you're ready, go ahead and proceed.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I just want to say, first off, it's an honor for me to be here. I was born and raised in this great state, and so I still consider it home, even though I've been in California for 15 years. And to think of my state, my home state, of wanting to be a safety net for the babies that this bill is being written for means a great deal to me. About 4 years ago, I was in my kitchen, and I was making dinner. And I heard on the news a story about a newborn baby boy. This little baby boy was found in a pink duffel bag with the words Lifesaver on it. And his body was found in that duffel bag thrown down a road just alongside the freeway. And when I heard the story of that little boy, I just thought, how in the world can somebody be that desperate and that scared to do something like that? Being the mother of three children myself, all I could envision were remembering my babies when they were newborns. And that's the face that I kept in front of me for several days. I called the coroner's office. I asked them what is going to happen to this child. And they said they'd do an investigation. It would take about 30 days. After the end of that time, this child would be cremated, and his cremated remains would be put in a little cardboard box with just a number on it. And I thought, how can anybody come into this world and never be known? And if they are known, it's only by numbers. And so I asked the coroner's office if my family and I could have that child become a part of our family, and if we may be able to have the honor of burying that child. Well, I called on one child, and by the time they were ready to release that child to us, there was already another newborn baby found in a dumpster. We asked for him, too. They called me to tell me that they were going to release that child to us, both of those little boys to us, and we could have our service for them. And then they said, Mrs. Ferris, we also have the body of a little girl. She's about the age of two, and we have tried in vain to find some family for her. Would you care for her, because we're getting the order to cremate her? And I knew at that point, when I had called for one child, and then there were two, and then there were three, I knew that this is something that happens, and I just wasn't sure if this was something that I could let my heart get involved in, because it hurts so much to think that somebody could just abandon children like this. But we did care for those three children on August 26th of 1996. And during the course of this last 5 years, we have buried the bodies of 44 children. I went to my state senator and I asked him if he would help put the Garden of Angels out of providing this loving business or this loving service for these children. I want these children to be recovered alive instead of dead. And at that time, the state of Texas had just passed their new law. And I said, one state's already done it, can we do it? And so he went to work right away writing some legislation. And I'm very happy to say that there were some amendments made to the bill. But on September 28th, our governor signed that bill into law, which became an effective law on January 1st. And it has already saved the lives of three children. This law is called the Safe Arms for Newborns Law. It's Senate Bill 1368 in the state of California. But this law was designed for the woman who is pregnant, who has not told her family or friends, who has not picked up the phone and called the wonderful agencies, the crisis pregnancy agencies that are out there, all the people that want to help, or the adoption services. She's kept her pregnancy a secret, and then she's given birth in secret, and now she just wants to get rid of this child. And it's usually within the first 24 hours of that child's life that it's abandoned because she doesn't want to get caught with it. So that is the reason that our bill was written. It's to give this woman a better option, a more loving option that she can use. Instead of taking her child to a trash can or a dumpster, she'd have a safe place like a hospital emergency room. It's been mandated in the state of California that every hospital emergency room, public or private, can be a safe place for a child to be taken to. The mother will bring in her child, put her child in the arms of an employee there, and then the baby is given a coded bracelet, and the mother is given a copy of that coded bracelet. And also in the pack that the mother is given is a medical history and background information form, and also a dear mother letter thanking her for bringing her child to the hospital. It is our hope, and it's enclosed in an envelope that has the address of the hospital and a stamp on it. So it's our hope that this mother will take that baby or take that packet home and fill out that medical history information and put it back in the envelope and send it off to the hospital so that that child can then have some medical history that will follow it. That mother is also, in the state of California, given a 2-week cooling off period, which will allow her to reconsider her decision. At that time, when the baby is brought into the hospital for the first 2 weeks, the baby is put into an emergency foster care home. And if the mother doesn't come back within the first 2 weeks, then the baby will go into the official child welfare system and be adopted, go into an adoptive family. But she does have that option to reconsider her decision. So we're trying to work very hard in the state of California to think about all the things that might come up for making this a good law, a law that will help save the lives of children. And I will honestly tell you that I always said that in the beginning, that if it saves the life of one child, it's been worth it. And to have it save the life of three children is worth it. And there's really not much that I can bring to you except for the children. And I really would like to tell you that when I go to a coroner's office and I pick up these babies and I unwrap the plastic off of them and I look into their faces and I see these perfect little individuals that were just thrown away like trash, I cannot walk away from that and say, this is all we can do for you, is to give you a burial and a name. We have to do something to make it different for the children of the future.
Debbie, could you please tell the committee, you have visited the people in prison who've gone to prison for this. You need to, I want you to understand there's no profile here of individuals that do this. It's very strong. You know that. And also, you mentioned 24 hours. Would you describe what the coroner said in terms of, you said 24, but 72. I don't mean to lead the witness, but I think you need to know because she's actually visited some of the people, the young people who've gone to jail for this. Would you tell them what you found in terms of profile?
The mothers that we know about are just a small handful, Some of them are teenage moms. We just had an instance that happened about a month ago. A 14-year-old had a baby in her home, and the parents didn't know she was pregnant. She gave birth to the baby in bed. The baby was making noise. She suffocated the baby. She started to hemorrhage, and her parents took her in to the hospital emergency room wondering what was wrong with her, and the doctor said, "You've just given birth. Where's your baby?" And so, you know, now there's a 14-year-old girl who's in juvenile hall that is always going to remember the face of this child that she strangled. I mean, I visit a young woman, she's 21 now, but a couple of years ago, she was an honor student at a college in Southern California. She came from a very close-knit family, very well-to-do family. And she became pregnant, and she, because she was so afraid she was going to disappoint her parents, and they might be ashamed of her, they might disown her. She was just so afraid. She just kept thinking about all this stuff that might happen. And when she gave birth to her baby, she strangled her and put her down a dump chute. That mother is now in prison for 5 years, and we write all the time to each other. I've been a couple of times to visit her. And I will be honest in telling you that I thought in visiting her, I was looking for the monster inside this woman that could do something like that. Because for me, I just couldn't imagine somebody being that scared and desperate and looking down into somebody's face and either throwing them away or strangling them to quiet them. I just couldn't imagine what kind of a woman could do that. And I have to tell you that this is a woman who is a tender-hearted young woman. And she has told me, you know, "I am so sorry for what I've done, and I have to live with that forever." And she said, "That's not me." She said, "I made a terrible decision." She said, "I'm always going to see the face of my baby forever. I'll never be able to get that out of my mind." So it's really difficult because there's really so many victims. The baby first and foremost, the mother, and then I look at the nucleus of the family that's around this mother and how they've been destroyed and what they've lost. So I just would ask you to please, please do put forth this bill. Carry it through. Make amendments, but make it work. Come together and say, "We need to do this. We need to do it for our babies." And you may say, we may not have as big of a problem as California has. But I do have to tell you that some of these babies, the numbers that you have are maybe just the babies that are only found. You may have many more babies than you realize, and they're never found.
Question, Senator Duncan.
I just want to comment, because I do have to leave to go to the other meeting, but I just want to thank you for coming. It's very, very enlightening, and I just admire you for what you've done, and you've really given life to lots of people. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Sorry, I have to leave. I'd like to hear the rest of the testimony.
Okay. Debbie, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Senator Courtney and I have kind of a long history in this body of dealing with issues like this since, I think, all the way back to 1989 and creation of multidisciplinary.
May I just say one more thing?
Yes, of course.
I know that everybody will always have questions. What about the mother? What about the father? What about this? What about that? But I would just ask you to please always remember, what about the baby?
The reason she's saying that, she held a conference yesterday, statewide conference, and groups are coming together like never before on this issue. And there are groups that are going to raise some concerns about the bill, I can tell you that. And there are issues in how do you notify the parents, adoptions, what about the child having a right to know who its parents are if you did save the baby later on, you know, because of the adoption issues. But the bottom line here is, and I hate to be so graphic, if the child's dead, all those things are irrelevant. And what she did, and she said, as I say, the coroner, they got a 72-hour period. You really have a person who's really messed up, and this has happened. She uses women, but I'll be frank with you, I've always used men. That is, there is a father who could be involved in this, too. She said mothers, but it could be the fathers. None of, it's that situation. The final thing is, this is a daring type of bill. I want you to be honest. I want the committee to know this. There she's talking hospitals. Our bill, as we presented it, and I'll be up front with you, it talks about fire stations, I believe, and police stations. I mean, it's more comprehensive. And I'm not trying to say that you may be afraid of that. You may want to go back and just make it narrower. I believe John Menis, I'll tell you something. I trust John Menis with a baby anytime because he's a cop and he's a good cop. And they know the right decisions, and our firefighters. So that was part of our bill. Sort of like Oregon likes to be the first or only, I was willing to look at our police and our fire. We put that in there, John, which is more than California did. So I want you to know that, this is California, but this is Oregon, the bill. Whether you want to do that or not, I don't know where you're coming from on that. I just felt I wanted to make a lot of options available to a person to know. Just take it here are the places you can take it. So I just wanted to be upfront with you. If you're starting to wonder, well, Peter, this is California Hospital. You've got the world. I don't have the world, but I believe in you, John, and I believe in the firefighters to do this as well.
Well, what I was going to say was there's been a long history in this building. There's been a long history in this building since at least 1989 where this legislature, the legislature created multidisciplinary teams.
Right.
The design was that every district attorney in the state of Oregon would have some kind of a multidisciplinary team to investigate child abuse, which from time to time includes child fatalities. There was the creation of the CAMI Fund, a child abuse multidisciplinary intervention account in 1993 that put money to that, which created an incentive to create the programs that are viable and working and functioning. 1991, I believe, we created a state technical assistance team to assist various counties and law enforcement agencies in investigation of various kinds of abuse, including child fatalities. We also have child fatality review teams around the state that, and I wanted to kind of alert people that in the current budget environment we have in Oregon, that child fatality review program is no more. It's been lined out, $1.1 million. So when we talk about issues like this, I think this is extremely important. One of the conferences that I attended on child fatalities back in Missouri, I believe in 1993 or 94, indicated that they had discovered that there were children who were part of a family who had gone across state lines, come back with one last child. And nobody knew the difference. So when you have, and it's kind of interesting phenomena, when you talk about finding a child that's 2 years old and the coroner, medical examiner, could not identify a parent, that's no joke. It happens in this country. You get to missing persons, just general statistic, 300,000 people in the United States each year are reported missing. Of that, roughly 3% are never, ever reported or found again, ever. And that includes children. So you think about that, start talking about the impact of missing literally that many people from our population in the United States as it grows. It's a phenomenal number of individuals. So I appreciate what you've had to say today. Appreciate this effort because it does go to the heart of trying to develop a compassionate system for persons who find themselves in a situation like this. So, Senator Breed.
Chairman, I also want to thank you for coming. Your testimony was very moving. You talked about the California bill and that three children have been turned in under that bill. Have there been any other children who have been found dead since that bill went into effect?
Unfortunately, yes. Last week, a little boy was found in an alley, a newborn baby boy. But I believe, really, if this is a wonderful bill and pass it, but you also have to educate that it is out there. I think if that's the whole key to making this bill work. We've put together public service announcements in both English and Spanish for radio and television. They're not out airing yet. We hope to do that in the next couple of weeks. We've created posters. We are doing everything that we can to try to keep this from happening. And I go into schools and I speak at schools. And that's an awesome experience to do that. And that's where we need to start, because we need to start in our junior highs, our high schools, and even in our colleges, and making them aware of this issue and that there are other options if you find yourself in this position.
Chairman, if I could follow up. How are you getting, because I agree with you, the education seems like it would be crucial on this. Who is supporting this education? Who's paying for it?
Well, actually, for us, it's the kindheartedness of individuals who believe the same way we do, that want to see this not happen to children anymore and want to be a part of saving lives, saving the lives of children. We are a nonprofit organization, and it's really because people have come together and said, what can we do to change this?
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Thank you very much, Debbie. Appreciate your testimony. Let's see, we've got Bob Castagna, who has to leave. I'll go ahead and call you up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate your indulgence. For the record, I'm Bob Castagna, Director of the Oregon Catholic Conference. The Oregon Catholic Conference would like to go on record today in support of Senate Bill 199. I'm passing out to you a copy of Minnesota Law, Chapter 421 of their Minnesota Laws 2000. At the Summer State Catholic Conference Directors meeting this past July, we discussed this type legislation that was being offered and adopted in other states. And my counterpart from the state of Minnesota was particularly supportive of this legislation. In Minnesota, they have established what is called Safe Place for Newborns, and on the board of directors is a priest from the cathedral parish, and on the advisory committee is the Archbishop of Minneapolis. The Catholic Church and the Oregon Catholic Conference adopts its public policy positions based on a consistent ethic of life, in which the dignity and sanctity of human life is the cornerstone value and forms the framework on which the Church adopts its public policy issues. And that consistent ethic of life extends from conception until natural death. So you will see the Oregon Catholic Conference here on a whole range of issues this session, be they human service issues, be they life issues, economic justice, or social justice issues. We have discussed this bill with Catholic Charities of the Archdiocese. They were not prepared to testify today because they had some concerns, and we'll be seeking a meeting with the chief sponsor of the legislation to discuss those concerns to see if the committee would open itself up to some potential amendments. Their concerns and conversation related to the potential for seeking some identification of at least the health history and potential reaching out either from the parents later on or from the child to those parents. And one provision of the Minnesota law, which I would call to your attention, which I do not see reflected in the at least hand-engrossed amendments, is contained in the Section 1, Subdivision 1, Subsection B of the Minnesota law. The sentence that reads, the hospital may not inquire as to the identity of the mother or the person leaving the newborn or call the police provided the newborn is unharmed when presented to the hospital. The hospital may ask the mother or the person leaving the newborn about the medical history of the mother or newborn, but the mother or the person leaving the newborn is not required to provide any information. The hospital may provide the mother or the person leaving the newborn with information about how to contact relevant social service agencies. We agree with the purpose of the bill, that the purpose of the bill is to save the lives of these infants, and that is a meritorious and worthy provision. We would also hope that the legislation would hold forth the possibility of at least inquiring at the time that the infant is handed over so that any identifying information which the personnel receiving the baby may voluntarily receive from the parent would be able to be documented so that for health history purposes as well as future family reunification purposes, even if that's 20 or 30 years down the line, that at least that possibility might exist if this information is voluntarily obtained. So the Oregon Catholic Conference thanks the members of the sponsoring group for this legislation. We do wish to go on record in support of it, but I think there is the possibility of at least engaging in some fine-tuning that we would place before the committee.
questions? Bob, thank you. Appreciate
thank you for your indulgence.
Grant Higginson and Kathy Ledesna. I'm not sure how to pronounce it.
Chairman, as members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson. I'm the State Health Officer and Acting Administrator for the Oregon Health Division, Department of Human Services, and I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 199, which would provide places where newborns could be safely surrendered without fear of repercussions. Excuse me. As a state health officer, one of my roles is to be the co-chair of the statutorily mandated state child fatality review team, which Senator Minnis already mentioned. Over the 12 years that I've been associated with that team, we have seen a number of tragic cases.
In which the church adopts its public policy issues. And that consistent ethic of life extends from conception until natural death. So you will see the Oregon Catholic Conference here on a whole range of issues this session, be they human service issues, be they life issues, economic justice, or social justice issues. We have discussed this bill with Catholic Charities of the Archdiocese. They were not prepared to testify today because they had some concerns, and we'll be seeking a meeting with the chief sponsor of the legislation to discuss those concerns to see if the committee would open itself up to some potential amendments. Their concerns and conversation related to the potential for seeking some identification of at least the health history and potential reaching out either from the parents later on or from the child to those parents. And one provision of the Minnesota law, which I would call to your attention, which I do not see reflected in the at least hand-engrossed amendments, is contained in the Section 1, Subdivision 1, Subsection B of the Minnesota law. The sentence that reads, the hospital may not inquire as to the identity of the mother of the person leaving the newborn or call the police, provided the newborn is unharmed when presented to the hospital. The hospital may ask the mother or the person leaving the newborn about the medical history of the mother or newborn, but the mother or the person leaving the newborn is not required to provide any information. The hospital may provide the mother or the person leaving the newborn with information about how to contact relevant social service agencies. We agree with the purpose of the bill, that the purpose of the bill is to save the lives of these infants, and that is a meritorious and worthy provision. We would also hope that the legislation would hold forth the possibility of at least inquiring at the time that the infant is handed over, so that any identifying information which the personnel receiving the baby may voluntarily receive from the parent would be able to be documented, so that for health history purposes as well as future family reunification purposes, even if that's 20 or 30 years down the line, that at least that possibility might exist if this information is voluntarily obtained. So the Oregon Catholic Conference thanks the members of the sponsoring group for this legislation. We do wish to go on record in support of it, but I think there is the possibility of at least engaging in some fine-tuning that we would place before the committee.
Questions? Bob, thank you. Appreciate
thank you for your indulgence.
Grant Higginson and Kathy Ledesna. I'm not sure how to pronounce it.
Chairman, as members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson. I'm the State Health Officer and Acting Administrator for the Oregon Health Division, Department of Human Services, and I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 199, which would provide places where newborns could be safely surrendered without fear of repercussions. Excuse me. As a state health officer, one of my roles is to be the co-chair of the statutorily mandated state child fatality review team, which Senator Minnis already mentioned. Over the 12 years that I've been associated with that team, we have seen a number of tragic cases where the outcome might have been different if this bill had been in place. And the cases all follow pretty much the same pattern. There was a young woman who, for one reason or another, wanted to hide her pregnancy and was successful in doing that. But that young woman gave birth totally unattended and alone, no medical support, health care support by any means. And then at a time when there was severe stress, emotional turmoil, confusion, that woman tried to dispose of that child in a variety of ways, and ones that I can remember were placing the child in a paper bag, in a plastic bag in the closet, another where the child was drowned in the bathtub where she had given birth, and another one where they had put the child in a dumpster, as you've heard is the case a number of times in California. The first time that I reviewed a case like this, I couldn't believe that it had happened, and even as a physician, questioned whether or not people really can hide their pregnancies through late term of pregnancy, and through discussions with the team, found out that indeed that is possible and does happen. The second and further times that we've reviewed cases like this, it did strike me that it would be a very, very simple and safe way to potentially avert cases like this if there was a place where, without any fear of repercussions, a woman could simply go and surrender that child. Senate Bill 199 does provide such a safe haven. Senate Bill 199 also provides for a public education campaign that actually would be the responsibility of the Oregon Health Division, Department of Human Services. We're not talking about a huge number of cases here, but as people, the woman from California mentioned, her belief and our belief as well is that if we could save one case, that is a true success, a real success. If we engaged in an extensive media campaign, that is something that would require a lot of money. However, I think that if we did a focused, much smaller campaign, that is something that the health division could do within our existing resources. So as long as the media campaign is not creating a fiscal impact which is outside of the governor's recommended budget, the health division is in support of Senate Bill 199. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. Any questions of Dr. Higginson? Senator Purdy.
You may not be the one to ask this question, but if maybe you'd know from previous programs that you've had, but is this the sort of thing where you might be able to get public service announcements on television without paying for them?
Chairman and Senator Burdick, yes, I think that it is. You know, one of the big cost items of doing public service announcements is actual production. But if the state of California or others have already done a PSA, then it would be a relatively simple thing for us to put an Oregon trailer on that instead of the one from the other state, and then we could ask for public service donated time. You know, that's not going to be great time. You have to purchase time to get good time, but at least that is something that we could do.
Senator Harper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Grant, I want to expand the authorized facility list. Give me some ideas.
Chairman, Senator Harper, that's something. Can we get back to you on that? Because that is something that I would like to talk to the Pediatric Society and other people about. I mean, that's my one concern about expanding the list, is that some of these infants are going to come in a medically fragile condition, and that's one concern I have. So I would be happy to think about that some more and work with the medical community on that. But if I could, I'd prefer to get back to you on that.
Well, I appreciate that. But let me leave you the thought that I'd like you to take back to the group. If you hand this kid to a warm body, they're going to have a better chance than not. So any list that, you know, you can constrict that from the warm body list if you want to, but. I think, you know, expand the chances as much as we can,
right,
reasonably. So,
Chairman and Senator Harper, I hear you, and I will do that.
All right. Thank you.
Chairman, as members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kathy Ledesma. I'm the Program Manager for Permanency and Adoption Services for the State Office for Services to Children and Families, also a division of the Department of Human Services. Like Dr. Higginson, I am here to testify in support of Senate Bill 199. This legislation is similar to safe haven or abandoned baby legislation adopted by bodies in other states in the past 3 years. At last count, we counted 14 states as having adopted legislation similar to this. Current count of states considering this type of legislation is 10, including the state of Virginia, who had introduced this session seven separate but similar bills, all that would be similar to this. All of these laws aim to protect the lives of children by providing the parents of infants with identified and safe places to leave them, as opposed to abandoning them in random locations such as dumpsters or motel rooms. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services conducted an informal search of newspaper articles on the subject and found that in 1998, 105 infants were abandoned in public places. 33 of those infants were found dead. Now, that is not an exhaustive list, but that's what they found from newspaper research. In Oregon, cases of abandoned infants are infrequent, one or two per year. We have provided the list compiled by our agency to Senator Courtney. Senate Bill 199 reduces the likelihood that parental abandonment of an infant would result in harm or even death to the child. SCF is one of two divisions of the Department of Human Services who would share in the state's responsibility to administer Senate Bill 199. The Health Division would be responsible for the public information about the statute, and SCF would become the legal custodian of all of the children abandoned under this statute. Although our roles and workload impacts are different, the two divisions concur that Senate Bill 199 is very positive and a proactive piece of legislation for Oregon's children. SCF has been in conversation with other parties who are interested in this bill, including the Department of Justice General Counsel Division. We have offered to Senator Courtney some proposed amendments. These relate to how the bill will be incorporated into and be consistent with existing child protection statutes. We don't believe that the amendments change the spirit nor the intended outcome of Senate Bill 199. And while our support of the bill is not contingent upon the committee's verbatim adoption of these amendments, we do believe that their adoption clarify and strengthen the intent of the bill. I did have a chance just before I came up to testify to take a look at the revised bill, and it does look as though most of those amendments have been incorporated into the bill as it now appears. In preparation for my testimony, we conducted extensive research on the development, use, and effects of so-called safe haven bills in other states and what national organizations such as the Child Welfare League of America have learned about the impact of them. I do have compiled here a notebook. I made a copy. This can go to Vice Chair Courtney or to you, Chair Minnis. It is a compilation of the development of all those laws in other states and some summaries of them. I won't recite the findings here, but I do want you to have that. In summary, SCF believes that Senate Bill 199 is a very good piece of legislation, especially with the proposed amendments, and we applaud Vice Chair Courtney for presenting it to this body, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have of me.
Okay, any questions? Senator Burdick.
Yeah, I saw one of these amendments changed the on line 11 on page 1, subsection B2 of section 1, where it changed a person to a parent leaving an infant is not required to provide any identifying information. Does this mean that if the parent turns it over to someone else and says, here, please go take this baby because I can't or won't, what would happen to that person?
Chairman, Senator Burdick, our concern about the vagueness of person had to do with some concern that a person may take an infant from a parent against their wishes and go and leave that the child in a place, and therefore the parent wouldn't have any control over where that child went and wouldn't know what to do. That was the concern, and that was why we proposed that that change.
Further question?
So to follow up, if a person then brought in a baby and turned it in and said, I'm not the parent, but the parent wants to abandon this baby, what would happen to that person? Would the person be guilty of any crime?
Chairman, Senator Burdick, I don't think I can answer that question right now. I think we'd have to think about that a little bit.
Well, again, what was the question?
The question is, if you're a parent and you want to turn the baby in, but you can't or won't go yourself, and you have somebody else do it, what would be the status of that person?
Well, I think that's an important question. It's one of the issues that I raised with Senator Courtney in terms of getting this bill to a public hearing. And part of the reason I mentioned the MDT model, because we have some fairly substantial laws relevant to abuse, and what I wanted to do is make sure that when we have a circumstance that rises to a level that it's protected under the statute, that there's a way that we can clearly define that. So I don't want to hamper the ability of law enforcement to investigate abuse cases, but when it's in essence determined by, and I'm assuming the district attorney, that this case is in fact a case that would fall under the statute, at that point law enforcement says, we're done with it. There's obviously no prosecution. You understand? And what I'm trying to do is coordinate between those two elements so that the child protective worker, the law enforcement community, medical community are in essence saying this statute governs this circumstance. And in that sense, it's not an abuse case, and therefore we have no interest in it, in essence. But that's that coordination piece that I think we're going to have to spend a little time on and make sure that we have in place clearly, so that we don't have detectives who are maybe going a little bit further than they should, or DAs that are not perhaps making that determination in the process. Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
You.
Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Beyer. Excuse me.
I guess a follow-up to Senator Burdick's question, and I don't know, it's probably defined somewhere, but when you say a parent, I'm a parent. If someone else gives me an infant, do I then have immunity because I am a parent? It doesn't say a parent of the infant. It just says a parent.
Chairman, Senator Beyer, point well taken.
Yes, and Senator Beyer is right, given the Boley case and PG v. Boley and the plain meaning of the language of the bill, he's probably right, so note that. Other questions? Thank you. Appreciate your time. And next person on the list is Laura Roche.
You're better than the mayor.
Is that you? I should know you, shouldn't I?
I'm getting
you look familiar.
Scary. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Maura Roach, and I'm here representing Planned Parenthood. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. As you may know, Planned Parenthood has 8 healthcare clinics throughout the state, and we have been providing the women of Oregon and their families with services and information on reproductive health care for more than 30 years. Senate Bill 199 seeks to address a serious and seemingly growing problem of newborn abandonment, and we support the bill's humane treatment of women who find themselves in this crisis situation. And while we are glad to see the focus of the bill is not about punishing women, this bill does point to a much bigger issue, which is preventing unintended pregnancy and the need for broad public access to family planning services. This session, you will also see a number of bills addressing the root causes of the problems Senate Bill 199 seeks to resolve. To name just a few, Senate Bill 421 requiring prescription equity for birth control, House Bill 3284 providing for urgent access to emergency contraception, House Bill 2309 and 10 increasing access to perinatal services, and House Bill 2885 increasing access to services for victims of domestic violence. Planned Parenthood has long advocated a broad-based approach, and we see Senate Bill 199 as just one piece of the solution. We need to provide more support in the form of education and services so that young women won't find themselves in these desperate situations in the first place. We do have one concern, and I'm not sure it's possible to address it in the bill, but as some of the previous speakers stated, some of these women are giving birth in secret, and therefore they're not getting proper follow-up medical care for themselves either postpartum. And I don't know whether we could include some way to create a referral for them at the time that the baby surrendered, or some way to try and address that aspect, but they themselves may be in need of some medical attention as well. Again, Planned Parenthood appreciates the efforts of Senate Bill 199, but we must do more work up front in the form of prevention to help young women make responsible choices and thus prevent unintended pregnancy. Preventing unintended pregnancy is the way to avoid the need for SB 199 in the first place. Thank you very much.
Okay. Mara, thank you. I appreciate your testimony. Any questions of Mara? Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
Representative Worth. Mm-hmm. Forgive me for not calling you up earlier. I'm getting to know everybody's faces.
It's freshman, so. I know. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kelly Worth. I'm a representative from District 35, which is in Corvallis, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak to this bill this morning, this afternoon already. I would like to sound my support and express my support for Senate Bill 199, and I guess give a perspective of a woman with a 4.5-year-old and 6-year-old. I'm a proud mother of very young children, so this is not a distant memory to me, having newborns. And unfortunately, the other side of my, I guess, personal firsthand glimpse of this tragedy was as I was working in a couple years ago for the Department of Army for a command group in Germany, and working for the commanding general, and so had to deal with a lot of the more tragic cases of the personnel. And one that sticks out in my memory very vividly was a young private who kept her pregnancy secret, gave birth, and put the newborn in a footlocker and went home on leave. And it was never determined whether this woman was suffering from postpartum depression or what. And I think Ms. Roche's testimony really speaks to the fact that this is only one component of a large problem that we need to, first of all, this deal with the abandoned children, the abandoned babies, but to find out care, continuing care for women, and find out what this is and not treat women like criminals. This bill is really about protecting the safety and health of newborn children. And unfortunately, it is a reality today that some infants are born into very unsafe and unstable conditions. And these, the most vulnerable children, need all the help and protection that a community and all of us can give them. This bill does provide for a community of safe locations where care and medical attention is available to these most vulnerable and desperate, fragile newborns. I think the most discouraging argument I've heard against this bill in other states, and as I've talked about it amongst my colleagues and different people, is kind of in the back of people's minds that the argument that this bill will somehow facilitate or motivate women to abandon their newborns. And I think that argument is thoroughly degrading to all mothers, and dismisses the tragicness of the abandonment of children by treating it as an act that women can somehow just be talked into with a little facilitation. So I just urge you to completely look at this bill as a way to provide an alternative to desperate women, a desperate people, a protected, safe alternative to a dumpster or a footlocker. Thank you.
Representative, thank you very much. Any questions for Representative Worth? But thank you very much
for
coming and testifying. Appreciate it. Josh Marquis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senator Courtney, members of the committee. My name is Josh Marquis. I'm the district attorney in Astoria. I'm also the president of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. And for the purposes of this bill, it may be relevant that I'm also on the board of directors of the National District Attorneys Association. I say that because when Senator Courtney originally approached me about this bill, my first impression as a prosecutor was a little bit of resistance. Until I spoke to a couple of my colleagues, David Barber, the district attorney in Mobile, Alabama, and Jim Backstrom, who is our state director from Minnesota. And Dave Barber started the program in 1998. They've saved, just in Alabama, no less than 11 infants with a bill like SB 199. I'm here to testify as a lawyer and a prosecutor why the DA's Association and why I'm personally in support of this bill. It's important to note, and I think I can answer one of Senator Burdick's questions, that what this does, the safe haven is created by creating a affirmative defense to the limited crime of child abandonment. It does not immunize a parent from being prosecuted for the abuse or murder of their child, but it does if the child is otherwise not abused or that parent is not involved in that abuse. It does create an affirmative defense, in other words, a defense that the mother or father, usually the mother, would probably have to raise. But essentially what it would do, it would create a bar for prosecution for those cases. Now, the question was raised about what about other person. Currently, the law only makes it a crime for a person who is a parent, lawful or lawful guardian, or other person lawfully charged with the care of that child. It doesn't deal with the issue about somebody who, and the issue that was raised, I think, by the health department about somebody who might grab a child from somebody else. And I've heard a lot of concerns from adoption rights groups, juvenile rights groups, other people, adoption people who want to encourage adoptions. This law is narrow and I think intentionally drawn. It's intended to create an exception for the criminal law so that with some public service announcements, which I think probably could be done probably without that much money with the cooperation of the media, could penetrate the consciousness of the community that would most likely be affected by this, is probably going to be younger mothers. I mean, I'm sure that there are many different people, but typically this is going to be a young person, probably substance abusing, scared to death, and it just having not knowing the criminal law, but generally thinking, I'm going to go to jail if I do this. 2 weeks ago, the Chicago Tribune wrote an editorial, which I forwarded on to Senator Courtney, specifically endorsing exactly this bill and citing, I think, 15 other states that already had it and enlisting, I think, 24 that were planning on having it. So this is not a Democrat or Republican issue. This is not a pro-life or pro-choice issue. It's not going to save dozens of children in Oregon, but it will save probably one or two kids. And as a prosecutor who has never been accused of not being aggressive in terms of wanting to go after people who commit crimes, I would much rather forego a Class C felony on child abandonment and see that child survive. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Keith, thank you.
Thank you.
Are there any questions? Appreciate it. I believe this is Matt Maddox. Is that correct? Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chairman. Senator Portman, other members. My name is Matt Maddox, and I'm assistant district attorney in Clackamas County. And I've been asked to appear here today because of my personal experience in prosecuting an 18-year-old woman, girl, last year in Clackamas County for drowning her newborn in a bathtub at a family reunion, during the course of a family reunion. It's a case where she was convicted of manslaughter in the second degree, and she's now serving a six-year sentence at Oregon State Prison. So I guess in the sense that I've been asked to appear as being sort of front line dealing with someone who had personally concealed her pregnancy from her relatives and a young girl because of her religious background did not want anyone to be aware of her pregnancy, and eventually locked the door in a bathroom at the home where they were having a reunion and drowned her baby. And in fact, she was in a physical condition, where she almost lost her own life.
I'm sure that's what I'm here to talk about, I guess, in my particular case, and I'm not sure if you have any questions relating to that.
Well, do you have any sense for whether or not a law of this nature would have perhaps changed that situation?
You know, it's hard to determine. I think that what was of utmost concern to her was anonymity. I think if she was in a situation where she could have left the child at a hospital facility and that her relatives not have learned of this pregnancy, that would have been most important to her. From a prosecutor standpoint, the most important thing from my standpoint is that the bill be narrowly constructed, just as Josh has just stated. I certainly don't want the bill to cover any situations where we have abuse, because I have prosecuted cases in the past where children have been taken to hospital facilities and eventually died at that facility, but they were taken, they were been abused prior to being taken to that facility, whether it's physical or sexual abuse. And so I want to make sure that from a prosecutor standpoint, that this involves child abandonment alone, that it involves newborns, and that we don't talk of that we don't have it cover any abuse, because that puts it in a different light.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jennifer Bissett.
Hello, my name is Jennifer Bissett. I work at Emmanuel Hospital. I've worked there 18 years on Family Birth Center.
At the home where they were having the reunion and drowned her baby. And in fact, she was in a condition, physical condition, where she almost lost her own life. Not sure that's what I'm here to talk about, I guess, in my particular case. I'm not sure if you have any questions relating to that.
Well, do you have any sense for whether or not a law of this nature would have perhaps changed that situation?
You know, it's hard to determine. I think that what was of utmost concern to her was anonymity. I think if she was in a situation where she could have left the child at a hospital facility and that her relatives not have learned of this pregnancy, that would have been most important to her. From a prosecutor standpoint, the most important thing from my standpoint is that the bill be narrowly constructed, just as Josh has just stated. I certainly don't want the bill to cover any situations where we have abuse, because I have prosecuted cases in the past where children have been taken to hospital facilities and eventually died at that facility, but they were taken, they were been abused prior to being taken to that facility, whether it's physical or sexual abuse. And so I want to make sure that from a prosecutor standpoint, that this involves child abandonment alone, that it involves newborns, and that we don't talk of that we don't have it cover any abuse, because that puts it in a different light.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jennifer Bissett.
Hello, my name is Jennifer Bissett. I work at Emmanuel Hospital. I've worked there 18 years on Family Birth Center, and I deal daily with families in crisis. Having babies is not always the happy experience we wish it was. We deal with abuse issues, drugs, mental illness, and frightened teenagers every day. And my personal experience to make this real is the baby that was dropped off safely at our hospital. This is a beautiful, healthy baby that was dropped off outside our maternity unit. And this is what this bill is about, to look at this baby and know that she is in a happy, healthy, safe place now and doing well. I think this says it all. There's a lot of mothers that we can provide social services for, but there's a few mothers that we've talked about here that are so desperate that no one knows pregnant, that they need this option to drop their baby off safely. And it would be my wish that someday this bill would expand to where the mother could come to the hospital and not have to deliver alone at home and scared, and leave her baby there and no more said about it. They did find this baby's mother, and it did not help her situation to be found. She had her reasons for what she did, and to tell you the truth, I think she was courageous to bring her baby to the hospital and drop it off. What a nice story to see this baby and not to hear the story about this baby found in a dumpster. And that's the nurses at the hospital.
All right. Thank you. Actually, Council's telling me that the country of France provides that particular kind of accommodation.
I hope one day that we continue to expand to that. I think the safety of babies and the welfare of their mothers, too, because they're desperate. They need help.
Thank you. Senator Courtney.
This is Baby Star.
Yes.
This is the Baby Star. Just so you know, this is Baby Star. I don't know if you've heard of that. This is the famous case.
This was 2 years ago.
Baby Star.
At Emanuel Hospital.
You know, this case is somewhat well-known, and it's Baby Star.
Senator Harford.
Tell a little bit more about the hospital stay aspect. From you say there's France does this, or?
Yes, I read in one of the newspaper articles surrounding this that France not only has the safe harbor for babies, but does provide that the mother can come to the hospital and anonymously give birth to the child there.
That's what you mean.
Yeah, I think we're on the right track, that I think the more we do to make safe for babies and their mothers, the more chances we'll have of having an outcome like this, which to me was a wonderful outcome.
Senator, were you through, Senator Harper?
Yeah.
Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Baby Star, and we're all familiar with that, especially from Portland. Has she been adopted now? And have there been any issues? Is there any risk that the birth mother will come back at some point?
They did find the birth mother in this situation, and I don't know all the details, but it was pretty much cleared up that they relinquished custody. Finding this mother and answering those questions, though, I think exposed her to what she didn't want, was people to know that she was pregnant, and I don't think it helped her or her family situation.
Follow up that. So you think it will be very helpful, the element of the bill that allows, if the mother doesn't come back in 2 weeks, that nothing more is, no more contact is made.
And as it is commonplace, as other states pass this bill, and it's commonplace that you can do this, I think it will make a difference.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. Diane Adams.
Hello. Thank you for letting me speak. I am also a registered nurse at Emanuel Hospital. I've been a nurse for 16 years, and in the last 11 years, I've witnessed many deliveries, many births, and it's a joyous occasion, as generally. But as a citizen, I don't have any personal experience with a woman who has probably hid her pregnancy, delivered alone, and probably terrified. It's terrified under regular circumstances, let alone alone at home, and left in a desperate situation, whether it's because of social or cultural taboos, as in Baby Star's case, or other circumstances. We've heard news reports of infants left in shopping bags and parking lots or on the roadside or even bundled in a blanket under a rose bush or, as in our case, by our coffee bar. These babies were found and they all had a chance. But what about those others that Debbie talked about earlier? We can give these frightened and desperate and confused women a choice. A safe haven for the babies, too, will ensure a better chance for the babies at life. And I really just support this bill. It will allow more of a choice for a mother during this really desperate, critical time event in her life.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Adams. Appreciate your testimony. Dr. James Lace.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Dr. Jim Lace. I'm a pediatrician here in Salem, and I represent the Oregon Pediatric Society and the Oregon Medical Association. And both of these groups are in favor of Senate Bill 199. And I just will go through a couple of additions on here. I checked the latest data yesterday, and we would be the 16th state. There are 15 states that have passed legislation so far. The second point I'd like to add in is that I think we need to get very creative with our public education part of this. And was thinking about this and talking with people about how to get into the mentality of these people that would do such a desperate act. And putting, you know, posters on back of toilet doors, bar coasters, next to condom machines, cigarette packages, lottery tickets, convenience stores, on all forms of alcohol sold in the state, continuing PSA programs, not just a one-time shot, but a continuing program, make this bill part of routine high school education, and I could go on with more ideas, but I think we need to make sure that we make a good effort to get this out into the public mentality. Also, I'd like to echo the comments that this also points up the issues about addressing other issues with teen pregnancy prevention programs, prenatal counseling, health services, adoption, and other support programs, and trying to understand, you know, why people would abandon their babies. The other thing is that I would suggest that we add in a part through legislative rules that the missing child information center be contacted to make sure that this is not a child who's been dropped off by somebody else because they hated that person or there's some other issue. Those are the only comments I want to add in.
All right, Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To pursue a comment that Senator Harper made a few minutes ago, as a pediatrician, what is your view on whether we should expand the number of locations where babies could be left off?
I would certainly be in favor of the warm body concept. I mean, you know, however we're going to define that warm body, but I think the intent is if somebody says, gosh, here's a baby, you know, they leave it there and they call somebody up and all of a sudden there's this baby brought someplace else, I would certainly be, you know, in favor of that. These are babies that may or may not be in a delicate medical situation. In other words, they may be hypothermic, they may be low on blood sugar, they may need immediate medical care. But the assumption would be that this other person, this other agency, would in fact be able to be brought in. We've had a couple of babies here at Salem, my own personal experience, with babies in a shopping cart, a dead one, and then another baby who was left in the hospital bathroom at Salem Hospital. And the mother just mentioned to somebody on the way out that there was a package in the bathroom. And somebody went in and said, oh my gosh, there's a baby in there. That baby's done very well. Those are my only two experiences, personal experiences, with abandoned babies.
Doctor, I have a question for you. The bill applies to a child that is 30 days of age,
yes,
or younger, as determined to a reasonable degree of medical certainty.
Yes.
Well, how would you accomplish that?
Well, I mean, you could say, well, I put in my comment in here about how you know if it's 35 or 40 days, and, you know, this is going to be a big issue. This also addresses another issue, which is, I made another comment in here. In 1999, we had 20 deaths from child abuse and neglect. Some of these babies, some of those children, those you know, would be affected by this because oftentimes these are families that have other problems on multiple levels. And so, in fact, you may be able to affect other children, not just that baby in that 30 days of life. A 30-day-old baby looks very different than a 1-hour or a 12-hour or a 24-hour-old baby. And I guess, you know, it's not a teenager. Those are very clear. You know, you got to keep your teenager, sorry. But those babies in that first month, again, if it looks like it's sort of a one-month-old, I would certainly not have a problem with that. And I would hope that we'd have some leniency because, in fact, the person dropping that baby off probably won't provide the information about the exact age of the baby, but reasonable, you know, medical certainty, I guess, would apply here, and that looks appropriate. So.
And actually, I'm asking it to build a record here because, I mean, the bill does say a reasonable degree of medical certainty, which is to say that it's really not certain.
Right.
But we're leaving that judgment
right
to individuals.
Close like enough. I think we'd all be in favor of that. Again, if the intent is to try to prevent a tragic death from abuse or neglect, we'd be certainly in favor of that.
All right. Thank you, sir. Appreciate your testimony. Ed Patterson.
Mr. Chairman, I am Ed Patterson. I represent the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and my members of my association include all the community hospitals in the state, including Legacy Health System. I'm pleased to see the nurses were here today. Mr. Chair, I'm here to say that my association does support the intent of this Senate Bill 199, but also I would preface my comments by saying that all hospitals are obligated to care for any patient that presents himself in the hospital. So it's not that this would require us to do anything differently, but there are some political legal consequences that have been expressed to me by my legal counsel, who normally would be here with me, but she's in D.C. This week. And I did receive a copy of the bill or the amendment that's requested by the Services for Children and Families, and I don't have the other bill that you're talking about in front of me, but just
that's
a couple of
the dash three amendments.
Dash
you're looking
three.
Individually at those.
Okay. So that would be incorporated into the hand-grossed version that we're looking at.
Yes, it's incorporated into that version.
My comments with my counsel, and I'd like to leave these with the committee, I realize there is some work to be done on the bill, but just so you're aware of our concerns, she commented to me about the issue that Senator Burdick brought up regarding the parent or person who brings the child to the emergency room. I think that's a significant issue, or could be. And I'm not aware of the legal consequences of what that may be, but the dash three also says that the infant must be 30 days of age or younger, which what happens if the infant is older than 30 days in terms of the implications to the liability of the hospital if you take care of a child that's more than 30 days, and must not be a victim or have evidence of physical abuse as defined in the ORS. My statement to you would be that we would care for a child whether it has physical abuse or not, but does this legislation then have some implications, even if unintended, that might affect the liability of the institution? Those are things that I think need to be addressed, and my counsel would be more than happy to work with any task force that you put together to help solve these. The other issue that she brought up, or one of the other issues that she brought up, is the issue on page 3, and I think it's the new section 8, and talks about the facilities, or defines the authorized facilities where a child may be brought. And included in that is an ambulatory surgery center. And I'm not sure that, and Senator Courtney and I have had this discussion, but I just want to put it on the record. I'm not sure that really is what the intent of the bill is. An ambulatory surgery center, in today's vernacular, is something of a facility. It's probably only open 5 days a week, and maybe then only from 9 to 3 or whatever, and does day surgeries. And they may or may not have any special medical expertise taking care of babies. So I wouldn't think that that's what you'd want to encourage, although in some cases maybe better than no facility. But the hospitals, we think, would be easier for persons finding themselves in need of some care for an infant. Hospitals are easy to find. They're easy to advertise, and I think might work better from a personal standpoint. But ambulatory surgical centers probably is not the solution to the problem. Those are the only comments I had, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to respond to any questions you might have.
Could you, Ed, go back and tell me again the portion that your counsel thought may expand liabilities for hospital? I want to make sure I understand that point.
Mr. Chair, it would be Section 1 of the dash 3s. And it talks about leaving the infant in an authorized facility if the infant, A, is 30 days of age or younger, and B, has no evidence of physical abuse. And her concern is, what if the baby is 31 days of age or older, or what if the child has had some semblance of abuse? We wouldn't want to deny the treatment of that child in either case.
Okay, that's a good question. I don't think it's intended to deny the treatment of the child. I think it more goes to the extent of whether or not it becomes a prosecutable abuse case as opposed to something that comes under the provisions of the statute. So, but
that was my understanding after listening to the DAs testify that that has legal consequences that I don't understand, and I'm sure my counsel would. But
I think it's a good point. We ought to make clear for the record that that's the case when we do the work session on the bill, or if there is a real liability issue, then try to deal with that.
And I would note, Chair and members of the committee, that the bill also does include an immunity provision in paragraph 4 of section 1 for a facility that's acting in good faith.
And to some extent, it kind of goes back to the statement with respect to reasonable degree of medical certainty and how flexible is that. And the question in the back of my mind is if this person comes in and says, well, I had this child 31 days ago. In fact, I remember the date because it was my birthday. And there's some information that says it's 31 days and not 30, whether or not that somehow changes
the
scenario. So we'll have to check that. Just see whether or not I'm creating a problem. I mean, in other words, if you developed evidence in the course of your chatting with this person that this child, in fact, was 31 or 32 or 33 days old as opposed to 30 days old, you now have some direct evidence as opposed to just medical certainty issue. So, all right. Thank you, Ed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Gail Atterbury.
Chairman Minnis, my name is Gail Atterbury. I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Right to Life, and I'm just here to give you a very short little testimony, and that is to tell you that Oregon Right to Life supports very strongly House Senate Bill 199. In fact, the Board of Directors of National Right to Life quite a while ago passed a unanimous resolution supporting these safe haven bills throughout the United States. We believe that it's a very positive and life-affirming type of bill that in which society can show their support for women that find themselves in this desperate situation and a way to save their unborn children. So it's a pretty short testimony, but I think it's important that we let you know that we are very supportive of Senate Bill 199.
All right. Thank you, Gail.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Nancy Miller and Timothy Travis. Tim, I think this is the first time you've testified in the Senate Judiciary Committee this year, is it not?
No.
Were you here once before and I forgot?
I was. It was eminently forgettable, Senator.
Yeah. Senate Bill 419, a big one.
Oh, how could I possibly forget that?
I get to go first, though, because he talks a long time. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Nancy Miller. I'm the director of the Juvenile Court Programs Division of the State Court Administrator's Office, and I'm here today actually wearing my hat as director of the Citizen Review Board Program. We just want to go on record saying that we strongly support Senate Bill 199. As a person who has spent my entire career as a child advocate, it was very painful for me to have to go into Senator Courtney's office one day and say, gee, Senator Courtney, I'm a little worried about Senate Bill 199. What happens the day after the baby is abandoned? Has anybody talked about that in terms of how it relates to the juvenile court process? And I'm just thrilled to say that the amendments that were brought forth by SCF clarify that, make it very clear that the juvenile court process kicks in on the day after. So now we have that question answered. So we are very strongly supportive of the bill and thank Senator Courtney very much for his willingness to listen to us and for bringing the bill forward. We'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Nancy. Tim.
Thank you. Timothy Travis, Oregon Judicial Department. I'm sort of asking myself why I'm here today, but I'll tell you why I'm here today. I read this bill initially, as we all read them in the course of things, and I had some concerns about it. And I mentioned them to someone at lunch who passed my concerns on to Senator Courtney, and I got a phone call from Senator Courtney saying, I understand that you don't like my bill. And I said, oh, no, Senator, I wouldn't not like your bill. So Senator Courtney and I had some conversation. I called my friend Josh Marquis, who I've known since undergrad days, and we talked these concerns out, and I said, well, I'm satisfied, Senator, now that we've got the SCF amendments. I'm fine with everything, no problem. I wasn't going to come in and testify against you anyway. And he said, I want you to come in and testify and talk about the reservations that you had so that they're on the record. I think Nancy pretty well covered those. We were concerned about the day after. What happens, how does this all fit with the juvenile court process? And as I say, the SCF amendments really do cover that situation. So we were concerned mostly about children's right to ancestry, Indian Child Welfare Act concerns, and things like that. And because we have the juvenile process kicking in, as usual, the next day with the SCF amendments, all those concerns are taken care of. So the judges, by the way, we have a database in which judges comment on bills. All of them said, gee, we really don't think this is much of our business, but we're very strongly supportive of the idea.
All right. Mr. Chair, one other thing, I'm sorry, to address one of the questions that you asked earlier in terms of coordinating with CPS and the police investigations. That was one of the things we were concerned about, and my read of it at this point, and smarter people than I can certainly read it, but my read at this point, now that it makes clear that it can't be abuse under 419B005 and that the juvenile court process in terms of abuse and neglect proceedings kick in the next day, I think that takes care of the concerns that you raised, and obviously more folks can weigh in on that. In terms of the concerns raised by the hospital, I agree with both what you and counsel to the committee said. This isn't about the hospital caring for the child. It's an affirmative defense for the parent. It's written very narrowly, so I would agree with your interpretation that the hospital's issue is taken care of as well.
Okay, now, Nancy and Tim, have you explored the issue with respect to anonymity? So, number one, I don't want to impede a legitimate abuse investigation that might proceed. And I can kind of envision one of these investigations beginning and then realizing this really comes under the statute. But you have the generation of certain law enforcement reports and SCF reports and so on and so forth. What happens to those records? Are they public information? Are they accessible? And what policy should govern in those circumstances?
Mr. Chair, we talked about this briefly, and I'm not sure if I'm exactly answering your question, so if I don't, let me know. When you talk about what happens the next day, and we really debated whether we wanted to bring this up, but when you talk about what happens the next day, SCF is going to have an affirmative obligation to look for those parents. That's going to happen. When a termination of parental rights petition is filed, SCF is going to have to try to locate the parents, summon them for the termination trial. If you can't find them, you publish for them. I'm guessing that's what would happen. And then a termination petition would be filed and it'd be over. If the child is dropped off and there's some evidence of abuse, then this affirmative defense doesn't kick in and you have your regular police investigation of abuse.
Right. And Senator, there will be terminations of parental rights on these children before they can be freed for adoption. And abandonment of a child is a ground under the Adoption and Safe Families Act for immediate termination of parental rights. Even if the parent is not prosecuted criminally for abandonment, abandonment still can be found within the course of the juvenile court proceedings, and so you have this immediate termination of parental rights under the Adoption and Safe Families Act. Another thing I wanted to clarify...
Just one thing, which addresses Senator Burdick's question of before about what happens if these parents come back. Their rights are going to be terminated.
Well, perhaps. Because we all can think of the situation where, in this moment of desperation, this parent may indeed take this course of action, but she may later, upon counseling and talking and like that, decide that she wants to be involved. If she came back, she would have the opportunity to work with SCF, and SCF would have the district attorney or the state would have the opportunity to determine whether or not that's appropriate, whether or not to go forward with reunification services or to go forward with abandonment.
Only if she comes back before the termination of parental
action. Once the termination is done, once the adoption is done, then nobody can come back. That's the regular termination law. The other issue that came up was the distinction between person and parent, and I'm not sure that it was clear. A person cannot be prosecuted for abandonment, because they're not the parent. Only a parent can be prosecuted for abandonment. That's why the bill says parent, because this is a defense to abandonment.
So they could still prosecute Roger because he's a parent.
Apparently.
Well, they might. If he's not the parent of this child, they may be prosecuting him for child abduction or for custodial interference or kidnapping, but they won't be prosecuting him for abandonment because he can only abandon his own child.
All right. The council has some questions, I think. Do some of the members have questions still?
Well, I just had one quick one because it was a question that came up earlier. So basically under current law, in that scenario where a person other than the parent who came and abandoned the baby in the hospital, they couldn't be prosecuted anyway under current law.
Senator Burdick, they could not be prosecuted for abandonment of the child, no. They could be prosecuted for abduction or custodial interference or for kidnapping, but only a parent can abandon their child.
Thank you, Chair. The Florida law provides a presumption that the parent who leaves the newborn infants in accordance with their law has intended to leave the newborn infant and consented to termination of parental rights. If we included something like that in our law, would that obviate the requirement of an investigation by SCF into the parents?
Chairman, Madam Counsel, I'm not sure that it would, because it depends on the strength of the presumption and what can be done to rebut the presumption, if anything. If it's an irrebuttable presumption, it's probably unconstitutional, but if it's rebuttable, it's probably constitutional.
So that's a provisional maybe.
Well, you know me, I'm a lawyer.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate you.
I like that one.
Jim Austin.
Chair Menace, members of the committee, I want to thank you for granting public hearing on this. And for the record, I am Jim Austin. I'm aide to Representative Kathy Lowe. Representative Lowe is a co-sponsor of this bill, and she apologizes for not being here today. She went home ill. And to spare you, just reading what I'm passing you would have been sort of her...
And so you have this immediate term.
The hospital, they couldn't be prosecuted anyway under current law.
So that's a provisional maybe.
To think it doesn't happen, it does happen. We have cases here in our own state where people are abandoning children, and this bill definitely addresses that needs. As to the motives for these individuals, why they're doing it, we can only speculate that clearly someone in a desperate place would do something like this, and this does indeed give them an option to place the baby in a safe environment, which is what we'd like. And the bill also addresses the issues of the need to create a public awareness campaign about this to make it effective. And that's about it. I guess I just...
All right. Well, thank you for your brevity. I appreciate that. Needless to say, Representative Lowe supports the bill and for the following reasons.
Yes. And for the record, I do too as well.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you, Jim. Diana... Honeheld, is that correct?
That's correct.
Thanks for helping me with that.
Thank you very much for allowing me to speak. Just so you know, this is my first time ever appearing. So if I am not familiar with the formalities, please forgive me.
We're not too formal, so just chat with us. You're doing good.
Okay. I have been very supportive of this bill for a very long time. Mainly, I want the committee to know I am a private citizen. I am not affiliated with any organization. 15 years ago, I was an unmarried pregnant woman. So I can very well relate to this situation. My son is doing very well, and I did not abandon him. Upon reading the bill, I was a little bit concerned about the way it was written under Section 2. It took me about 3 or 4 times to read it to understand that the parent or the parents would not be prosecuted. So I would like to make a suggestion of maybe clarifying that a little bit better. I also have a few items, which I believe have a number of them have been mentioned. I don't know if you have amendments, because I have not seen them, so they might very well have been covered. I think there should be a 30-day limit imposed upon the abandonment of the child to a proper facility for the biological parents to change their mind. This window allows the parents to reclaim their child. This option that is added to the bill will prevent an accidental abandonment or surrender of a child by a relative of the family, or in case where you have one child, one parent who wants the child and then another parent who does not. And I think since medical technology has advanced, especially with DNA testing, I would say very well assured that the parent that is coming forward is the actual parent. The other one I would suggest, once the 30-day limit is that all parental rights are permanently terminated, this should automatically include any of the father's biological rights, especially so that no a father can come forward and say, I was not aware that the woman was pregnant, because the child should be at that time been placed with permanent adoption. I don't know if this is just a technicality, but I feel that one state agency should be in charge of this. It should be included in the advertisements, so that any adopted parents can go ahead and properly register with this agency so that they'll be ready and willing to be able to take the children. One thing was mentioned, what if parents or the children want to find their parents when they are adults? I think the DNA test would be a great way to start this off, if it has it of a record, and especially now that adoption records are open. This allows the parents, say, you know, I abandoned a child this time, the record, whichever agency, adoption agency, would then be able to locate the child, especially too if the child has requested it. These are just my personal opinions, and I hope you will consider them. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. You did a good job.
Thank you.
Fine job. Now, not a question for you, actually. It's kind of a question probably for Tim Travis or Nancy.
Okay.
When we talk about the parent, we talked about termination of parental rights. I mean, when you have a child born, you obviously have two parents. What happens to the other party? I mean, my assumption throughout the testimony is you have a woman who's the birth mother bringing the child in and in essence, abandoning the child, which would give rise to termination of parental rights. But what about the male half of the relationship?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Timothy Travis, Oregon Judicial Department. In a case where you would have a child that was abandoned by one parent and the other parent was a person unknown, the agency has a duty to try to locate who that person is, who that father is. If they cannot figure out who that father is, there is a procedure of serving by publication, serving a John Doe. There is a process for extinguishing that parent's rights in that parent's absence. It is not as easy as just saying we're going to, by law, say that if a mother abandons the child, then the father is also cut off automatically. You do have to go through this procedure. But as I said in my earlier testimony, this kind of a situation kicks into gear an expedited process for termination of parental rights.
Okay, it does not. How would an investigation be conducted? Would the medical records in the hospital or the medical facility be available to those investigators?
Yes, they would be. All of the records would be available. And if they were to identify the mother, then they would obviously ask the mother who the father was.
Okay, great. Thank you, Senator Brady.
Yes, thank you.
Chairman, if this bill passes, if the father comes in within 2 weeks, identifies himself as the father, or, you know, either hears, sees the notification or finds out through some other means, then what is his legal status? Does he have, if you can establish his paternity through DNA, does he have legal custody of that child?
Chairman, as Representative Burdick, it would go on a case-by-case basis. If the father identified himself to the agency, because the agency does have protective custody of this child, just as it would have protective custody of any child, the agency will work with that father, try to determine, first of all, establish paternity. Second of all, they are going to assess him and his support systems, and they're going to make a decision based on his ability to parent and where was he, why didn't he know this was going on. Perhaps if Ms. Ledesma is still here from SCF, she can answer this a little bit more detailed than I can. But that they would go through a process to assess whether or not he is a resource. And they would make a determination whether he is a resource, as they would in any other case involving a mother and a father who are not together.
Okay. Are you satisfied with that?
It raises some questions, because if you had a situation where perhaps one person wanted the baby, one person didn't, and one of them scooted out the door and abandoned the baby, then the other person, you know, I think it just raises some issues that ought to be considered.
I guess what you're saying is, Tim, is that process already exists, and since it comes under the juvenile code and it kicks in, then that process that we're currently involved in would cover these situations. So they would try to find the putative father and all of that stuff.
That's correct.
All right, Tim, thank you. Appreciate it. And I've buried my list here. Mr. Bishop, last person. If there are other persons who do wish to testify, please make yourself known to us.
That's why you got to get out. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, and I'm here on behalf of Kaiser Foundation Health Plan. Kaiser operates a number of large multi-specialty medical offices, and the specific concerns that we have with this bill, which we support, are that the definition of hospital is both inapt. It may include some facilities that you don't intend it to include or wouldn't think of as a hospital, and so we'd suggest that you look at the definition of hospital to see if that's the appropriate definition. But that definition in the bill now does not include large medical offices, which to many people would appear to be a hospital. In Salem, Kaiser has two examples of those, one on Skyline, one on North Lancaster. Those are not hospitals because they're not licensed as hospitals. They're not open 24 hours a day, and they don't have emergency departments, but they are large medical facilities, and they would not be encompassed within this bill and within the immunities that would be provided by this bill for an abandonment. The issue is, I think, really a policy one for the committee of what breadth of qualified facilities do you want to define in the bill? Should it be narrow, limited to hospitals, or a subset of hospitals, or should it be a broad array of facilities, medical or otherwise? And that really is a policy issue, but we wanted to bring to your attention that at least the way the bill is drafted now, it doesn't encompass some large medical operations in the state. We would also suggest that you consider broadening the immunity for any healthcare provider or physician or other good Samaritan who takes a step to intervene in these kinds of circumstances. As the bill is drafted now, the immunity under the bill only applies in one of these authorized facilities for certain personnel in those facilities. And again, we understand the purpose of the bill to encourage good Samaritans to step forward, and would request that you look at specifically whether broader immunity ought to be provided in that circumstance.
All right.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Bruce, do you know if we have a definition statute of, what is it, medical facility?
There is not.
There is not.
We have a criminal statute.
We do have a criminal statute, I at least
Okay.
There's a reference there.
I'm not aware of that.
Okay. I think your suggestion's good. The Good Samaritan statute exists, and maybe wanting to couple this to that. So, any other questions, comments, statements? All right. Thank you, Mr. Bishop. Appreciate it. Anybody else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 199?
Good Samaritan.
Any additional comments from the committee?
Yeah, I do. I want to thank you, Mr. Chair, and all the members of this committee, because, you know, we ordinarily would not meet at this time, and you're willing to do that, Mr. Chair, and I really appreciate that. And I know Senator Metzger's been running between two committees, and Senator Vern Duncan had to run over to committee, and he wanted to be here. And I know that, Roger, others, you may have had appointments you've had to cancel. So I really appreciate your willingness to do this. I want to thank all the witnesses, many of whom have come some distance to testify on this issue. So I really appreciate that very much. I think it's been a very good hearing on this issue, and hope the committee feels that we've gotten a pretty good feeling for the issues involved and concerns. And I hope that the bill itself and the amendments have gone a long way to try to really reach out to the different concerns and issues here, Mr. Chair, even though I know that I can tell by being around you that you want some more work done on the piece of legislation. I do hope in the end, though, that we'd be willing to move it forward. So, but thank you very much.
I think the hearing is productive in the sense that there were a number of issues that were raised, and so I will defer to the Vice Chair when you feel that there are amendments that satisfy the concerns raised and that you've got the support of the committee. We'll bring it back for work session. Okay. With that, we're adjourned.